Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Patrick Brenner here, president and founder of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. Thank you for joining us for another episode of SPPI TV, the weekly public policy podcast of the Institute. I am joined today by our very special guest, Mr. Don Seufer. Don and I met during the Permissionless Education Conference sometime, I forget, Don. It was sometime last year. Let's get you on screen.
It was the fourth quarter. It was November in Las Vegas.
That's right. It was like right after the election. It was perfect timing. Very low key, no pressure. And tell us more about the Microschooling Center, the National Microschooling Center.
Well, terrific. So, Patrick, as you're well aware, not a lot of people fly to Las Vegas to see any great examples of education innovation. That's something that's been the case for a long time. Microschooling, though, is different. The National Microschooling Center is, as a center, we're only about a year old. We are all former microschool founders, leaders, and current microschool parents ourselves. We insist on that for our team. And our work is national, and it looks very different in different states. We have the school choice-friendly states like Arizona and Indiana and Florida or West Virginia, where the work that we do is ensuring that microschools, and I'll talk about what they are in a second, have access to school choice vehicles in ways that lets microschools be their best selves. But also a lot of this in the states that don't have school choice or are not likely to see education savings accounts anytime soon, despite them being overwhelmingly popular and an educational success, are a matter of helping these regulatory frameworks that had never anticipated permissionless education or non-traditional learning environments to the popularity tune that they are now, really stay out of harm's way and help regulatory apparatus and ways of doing things that had never anticipated this modernize so that they can bring the important world of microschooling in America into their, so that it keeps what makes microschooling great is that whether it be the founding families or the educators, these are just the people who are the local leaders that America needs. They come from all across the spectrum in every way that you could look at it. They're diversified in their backgrounds. They're diversified in the missions of their microschools. We have microschools that are a full academic calendar. We have microschools that are hybrid microschools that work with kids working in the homeschool rules within their state. Microschools are permissionless, innovative, small learning environments that generally operate outside of existing systems. These are millions of families who've just taken it onto themselves to no longer rely on government to solve their families' educational needs and are creating these really terrific and completely diversified ways of learning outside of the system around the country. And the National Microschooling Center helps them in every way that we can. We do free training programs. We're foundation backed, so we don't charge microschools for the work that we do. And we work with them to help ensure that the policies in their state are supportive to them. We help them with training. We help them with learning tools. And we really have the opportunity to have a front row view of what is, to me, the most exciting education narrative in America in generations.
It's reminiscent almost of the one-room schoolhouse of the days of yore, which is something that I would like my children to experience. We just haven't had the opportunity to pull the trigger yet. And there's not really a large micro-schooling community where we live in New Mexico, whereas that's certainly not the case in Las Vegas. And we know that because during the Stand Together Permissionless Education Conference that you were so gracious to host all of the guests in Las Vegas last year, you were gracious enough to arrange such great tours for all of the participants of the conference to really get an experience at all the different microschool options that are available, at least that were available on the ground in Las Vegas. Tons of different variety, a huge spectrum of different options and opportunities and offerings from all the different microschooling ecosystems, environments, everything. It was fascinating. There were schools that I really liked, but then there were schools where I respect that parents send their children there, but I wouldn't send my own children there. And I respect that decision of people being able to choose which micro school to send their kids to. But it's almost like there's four real categories of education. There's the typical public school where your school is determined by a zip code, and there's not a whole lot of option for parents to be able to determine which public school they go to unless they make the decision ahead of time and choose where they live as the determining factor for selecting a good public school district. Then there's private schools where you, you know, pay tuition and you can send your children to a private school. And we just talked last week with Sean Peterson, the CEO of Catholic Ed Partners, about how Catholic school, private Catholic schools, which I am a product of, how private Catholic schools really survived well throughout the COVID-19 pandemic because they didn't close. Then from private schools, then you've got charter schools and a whole different variety of charter schools. I was also a product of a charter school at one point in my life, and then homeschooling. And I was also a product of I was a product of all four of those different types of education: public school, private school, charter school, and then homeschool. But now we're entering a new field of a micro school. And this is really cool. And I'd like you to take a few minutes, Don, if you would, and talk more about exactly what a micro school is. Let's define it.
Sure. So micro schools are outside the system. And the National Micro Schooling Center works with anybody that identifies as a micro school. So we'll help anybody, but it needs to really be a multifamily learning environment. If you're doing something great with your own kids as homeschoolers, that's wonderful. We'd love to help. But a micro school needs to be a multifamily learning environment. That said, depending on the different state that they're in, sometimes they'll open as private schools, whether accredited or unaccredited. Sometimes they'll open up as learning centers that can serve kids operating in their state's homeschool framework for states that have a good, healthy homeschool program. And in those cases, they can be hybrid. They can be 5 days a week, like a school calendar, although they can also be 2 or 3 days a week and give families the opportunity to really, in a true learn everywhere spirit, combine the responsibility, the lift for their child's learning from different sources, right? Which is just a great way to do things. We have charter schools that are, well, in the school choice states, charter schools are realizing that maybe it provides a different track and a better, more flexible way to serve their kids if they do it as a non-charter school micro school. Because remember, a micro school it's the beauty of a micro school is it's great that it's small. And in lots of places like the Clark County School District in Las Vegas, small is an incredible virtue by itself that's enough for a lot of people. That said, because it is small, you have the opportunity to truly build the teaching and learning around the needs of the individual kids that you're serving in a relationship-based way. I call it an active learner paradigm. Your parents are really welcomed in as active partners in their child's learning trajectory in ways that very, very rare to see that in a public school setting. We have some states where charter school authorizers are realizing which way the wind is blowing and allow for hybrid arrangements. Like I work with a wonderful micro school, Haven Academy in Colorado Springs, where the authorizer lets them have a charter school in the morning, providing the building. And one of the beauties of a charter school is that even that you do need to conform to state standards and requirements in lots of ways, state dollars go behind it. So these families are able to choose that in the morning, and then in the afternoon they reconvene in the same schooling as a micro school, and they practice Christian learning and Christian education in a way that truly gives those particular families what works best for their own kids. So micro schooling can be all of these things. We talk about micro schooling like it's this hot new sexy buzzword in American education, and in a lot of ways, as a trend, it is very exciting. But I'm also reminded that the 1863 model of micro school, you know, the one room schoolhouses that dotted the American prairies when slate blackboard started traveling the prairie on trains, is a very popular form of micro school. And it's updated in many ways by some modern pedagogies, or maybe by a commitment to things like Montessori or child-centered learning that really would not be possible in most regulated state frameworks to do a true, for instance, Montessori or child-centered program or a forest school model living up to its potential and at a small scale, right? Because in some states, Nevada, Maryland, New York State have incredibly regulated private school rules. I know that in New Mexico, that's something that during the pandemic has changed somewhat. And the local regulators have some significant opportunity for discretion, whether it's helpful or not. in the ways that, you know, the private schools are regulated so that sometimes it makes sense to be a private school as a micro school and sometimes it doesn't. But the beauty of micro schooling is that it you can build them around the needs of individual learners, and it lets you do things in ways that you just wouldn't find possible in other sectors of education. And I've got a long background in the school choice world and working with private schools and with charter schools and with different versions of school choice. And micro schooling is so different from each of those in so many different ways. And the families involved in it and the community that microschooling has built represents that, right? So we have families that are coming in that never would have identified as non-traditional learning families or never would have identified as schools of choice families. They come from all across the political spectrum, left, right, and center. Many of them simply reject their state's academic content standards as being the most relevant to prepare their kid for the future that their child is going to have. We have families that care more about social and emotional growth than they do about academic learning. Faith-based learning, I think that, Catholic school enrollments are booming in some places. The Catholic Church, like lots of institutions, has struggled in terms of growth. But I think that there's some amazing stuff happening in highly innovative Catholic microschooling. Paula Scholar, the superintendent of the Los Angeles Diocese, does phenomenal work with microschooling, and I think that's contagious around the country. And I think that for churches that sometimes have classrooms but are too small to run schools under their state's private school regimes are opening micro schools at a pretty great rate. And I think that's part of the diversification of the movement that's making it so compelling and so making that growth so irresistible.
Sure, sure. I mean, those are great stories. I was unaware of how explosive the Catholic micro school was. I was unaware that there were Catholic micro schools. It's I know that now. You learn something new every day. What is it like? Let's talk about what a family would have to do in a state like Nevada, in a metropolitan area like Las Vegas. What would a family have to do in order to enter the microschooling arena with their family? Let's say they have a couple of kids. How do they get their families and their children involved in a microschool? What do the funding mechanisms look like? Do they have to pay out of pocket? Let's talk about that and the obstacles that are associated with it and how we overcome them in states that are particularly unfriendly to education choice like New Mexico.
Yeah. And Nevada is not a school choice state really either. There's a tiny opportunity scholarship program that is incredibly difficult to work with. In generally nationally, right? Just about 90% of micro schools are tuition based. They're being creative on both sides of the ledger, in terms of expenses and in terms of finding ways to generate dollars to work with, so that they're not relying on school choice dollars. Because the other dark side of the school choice world is that there are hoops that entities that want to participate in school choice programs need to jump through. Like for instance, the state giving the state test to all of their kids, or being subject to seat time requirements, or in some states, floor plan requirements to be a private school that's eligible for the program, or accreditation. The beauty of so many of these microschooling opportunities is that you really can design the model on a flyer on the needs of your particular learners. And if you need to be subject to an accreditation regime that can be incredibly expensive, incredibly intrusive, and lock you into a set of curricular, choices that are no longer going to meet the needs of your families, microschooling just lets you do things that those other sectors don't allow you to do. So Nevada, in Southern Nevada, and we have microschools across the state, we have about opening, starting with the coming school year, we're going to have more than 25 microschools within about a 10-mile radius. And let me use my own family as an example. Yeah.
Patrick. What was it like 10 years ago? So there's 10 years ago, 24
even before
now.
The pandemic.
Okay.
This is something that came about during pandemic. And if I'll tell a quick origin story, if you like, because I think it's a fascinating. During the pandemic, I come from a more traditional school choice world. I was one of the leaders of the state charter school authority. I was in talking to the leadership of the city of North Las Vegas, all elected Democrats at the time, the fastest, hardest working and poorest city in Nevada, about what they were going to do when the fifth largest school district in the country shut down and just was not going to be there in any meaningful way for their families, equitably or inequitably. And we realized that we needed to do something drastic. So what we did was really innovative. The really forward-thinking leaders of the city gave us access to their rec centers and libraries. My chief of staff and I Worked through the night, and I knew about microschooling models, and I knew what we wanted to do. So they hired our nonprofit using city dollars, completely outside of education funding streams, because they've been mistreated and disabused by the Clark County School District, the fifth largest in the country, for 30 years, right? So this is a history of underserving these families. And let us run microschools in their rec centers and libraries every day in person during the pandemic on three different sites. And what the city did was they said, we'll make this free for any of our residents if our residents withdraw from the school district and register as homeschoolers and follow the homeschool rules, which is a pretty controversial thing for a whole team of all elected Democrats at the time, let alone anybody, to do. And the political, they came after us pretty hard from lots of different directions. And the attorneys general were, what is Mayor Lee doing? Is he opening charter schools without permission? And it was really, really successful. Our kids, I know having an education background that kids were going to be behind. More than three quarters of our kids were more than two grade levels behind when we got them. And frankly, educationally, that had nothing to do with the pandemic. That's been the case forever in North Las Vegas.
State of New Mexico.
yeah. But we had phenomenal success. It was not a drill or kill program. It was a pretty great program that had lots of really interesting components to it, a full-time music educator and everything else. And we worked with the Rand Corporation to do a case study for the The Rand Corporation, okay, out of Washington, D.C., the sort of national defense industrial based think tank, that their seal of approval is pretty important in the education world as a validator. Because one of the things that we did was we were not going to administer the state test, but we relied on learning tools that were embedded. We had assessments embedded in the learning tools that we used that we wanted to work with, mainstream academics to establish the validity that you can really do this. Because to me, I don't know what public school accountability even means or what its future is. I'm not bullish on it. And it's not very true. It's not very meaningful accountability, but at the end of the day, it is a reliance on a state test. And the only value of that to me as a charter school oversight official was what you do with the kids that you have over the time that you have them and the academic growth that those kids have, right? Snapshot proficiency rates don't tell me a whole lot other than something about the household that the child woke up in the morning, right? But if you can move those kids academically, you're really showing that your impact is measurable and significant. And we averaged 2 years of academic growth in year one of SNUMA during the pandemic, and the Rand case study validated that, which was terrific. And it really got a lot of positive attention. Suddenly we had 25 microschool leaders meeting in our office on Thursday night saying, how do we do this? How do we do outside of the system microschools? And it's an incredibly diversified base. I love it. We have at our first public events, we had like three families show up. At our most recent ones, we have over 200. And we have schools that are so child-centered. Our own children last year were in a terrific microschool, Bloom Academy, that you can read about online. It is so child-centered. They choose to not have a curriculum. Kids are the rate of learning is actually really remarkable. Our you would think that kids must play all day, but our kids would be eating lunch in the car on the way home because they didn't have time during the day to eat lunch because they were so caught up in working with. They brought in architects. They brought in people that work in the stock market to teach these kids the way the child themselves want to learn. And it's really
they make learning fun again, Don.
Yeah. Right. It's what learning really can be. So we have truly Montessori microschools. We have faith-based microschools. We are launching a terrific arts-infused micro high school in Las Vegas this fall that are going to be just incredible ways of learning. And the beauty of it is, so this next year, our kids are going to be going to three different microschools.
So they're not going to Bloom again this fall?
They're not. They're okay. Older now, right? And sure. Bloom is made a decision to double down on younger kids, and we're helping them do that. And that's wonderful. But the beauty of a microschooling sector is that kids can move from one to the next, and it's a healthy thing. Even for, you don't even need to wait till the next school year to do it. And microschool leaders are super supportive of it. Their demand is busting at the seams. And a lot of them are.
Are you worried about the social impact of changing their circle of friends so frequently? Is that a concern?
That's a great question.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, Kids in my, so I was in the charter sector. I was working with the KIPP schools. KIPP charter schools are one of the big powerhouse national networks of charter schools that the kids thrive exceptionally well academically. And it's a no-nonsense, serious learning model. And I was working with them when they published, when they released, they did a remarkable self-study called KIPP to College, where they realized that the kids from these amazing K to 12 schools were not thriving when they got to college because they, for a variety of reasons, but really keeping kids so busy that they don't have time to bully other kids is not a way to teach them the important lessons in life that let them thrive when they get outside of that environment, where microschooling is a place where children can thrive. Their relationships with other kids and the grownups leading the microschool are deeper and richer because they have, it often is less structured. Sometimes it is quite structured, but it gives them the opportunity to really thrive as decision makers. They have choices about how they're going to spend their time and what they're going to do in their relationships. Think of how much, Patrick, in your public school days, and I was a product of public schooling myself, you waste a lot of time during the day.
Yes.
Where in a microschool, all of the time, really, I spend so much time in them, is valuable in so many ways, where kids are deciding what they're going to do next and the nature of the ways that they're going to engage, whether it be project-based learning or whatever it is that they're going to be working on that day in any investigative learning sense. And it really provides, to answer your question, a richer social environment that kids really come in and thrive from. And if they move to different microschools, that seems to multiply and not diminish.
That's great. I had no idea. It's almost like the science of social interaction behind the microschool. There's a science to it.
Right.
And I'm sure that as the microschooling community grows and the number of microschools grows and the number of parents accessing and utilizing the educational options available to them from microschools, that we'll just learn more about that science behind social interactions. Something you talked about that I want to touch on really quick just how much time public school students waste during the day.
Yeah.
I was at a private Catholic school from first grade through fourth grade. First through second grade was Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic School in on the outskirts of Denver, Colorado. And then my family moved us to California, and we went to, I think it was St. Mary's outside of Vacaville or in Fairfield in California. And I went to St. Mary's for third and fourth grade. I remember third grade very well and fourth grade very well. Sister Maureen was my third grade teacher, and Miss Fry was my fourth grade teacher. I remember getting into Oregon Trail. That was a very distinct memory I had as a child. But the long division, the math that we learned in third and fourth grade and all of the other mathematics, and we were actually just getting into algebra at that point. But by the time fourth grade rolls around, my family had made a decision to restructure the education model within the household. And fifth grade, the first semester of fifth grade, I went back to public school, and they didn't know what to do with us, Don. It was wild. They literally did not know what to do with myself and with the other students that were considered gifted. And we weren't gifted. We were just at that point where we were so far ahead of the other public school students that they called us gifted so that they could send us into the corner and tell us to read. What was that book? The Five People You Meet in Heaven. And I remember reading that book as a child in fifth grade, but they had us do all of these special projects outside of the normal flow because we were so much more advanced. And that's not saying that we were exceptionally smart students or anything like that. We were just so much farther ahead, and we continued to stay ahead because they essentially created this micro school niche of myself and these four other students in that fifth grade classroom. And we continued to learn at our own pace. And we challenged ourselves, and we had this micro school in a public school. It was great. And then we made the decision again to that something wasn't working out. I don't remember the exact details, but I went back to charter school, Buckingham Charter School, which was like a hybrid homeschool in-person model. And what happened then? That was a good experience. I learned the Hail Mary and the Our Father in Latin. Because of the homeschool aspect that my parents instilled into the homeschool students of the Brenner household. But let's get back on track. Sorry about that. We just finished the discussion on the social impact that students have as they change micro schools or they change their environments. And I never really had a bad experience changing my environment in my days of switching between schools essentially every 2 years or more frequently than that as a child. And that's something that a lot of military families experience on a regular basis. And something that we heard from Kirtland Air Force Base here in New Mexico in the Albuquerque area is that the public schools are not providing an adequate education for military families. I don't know if you have any experience with military families and serving the military community from the perspective of a micro school. I'm wondering if we can talk about that or if that's not something you want to talk about and we can move on to something else.
Yeah, no, I actually have quite a background in that. Well, prior to my doing this work, I was an education researcher, and I wrote 2 papers for the Gates Foundation about the challenges that military families face around the country. And I spent a lot of time actually on campus at schools or on military bases around the country that serve military-connected kids. And the challenges, right, of just being, you know, just being transferred and having to do something often on short notice and often during the school year to different schools is something that's a real challenge that is pretty unique to military life. And the different services have different ways of handling it. And some of them are better than others, and some of them are quite good. But it's a constant challenge for, you know, because whether or not states align with Common Core within a state, within a school district, the scope and sequence that kids are learning from, let alone the non-academic challenges of picking up and moving that often, are real challenges. So that microschooling is remarkably popular for military families. And wait, let's talk about microschool founders for a minute, because that's such an important aspect of this. So many of our microschool founders, first of all, those that have education backgrounds, really are that one life-changing educator that you had during your career. We hear a lot, you know, we try to catch them, like we like to say, we try to catch them after, when they make up their mind that they need to leave the classroom, because, you know, but catch them before they leave the profession. That we, one thing we hear a lot is, I got tired of having to kick my classroom door closed so that I could teach the way that I knew I really needed to teach to connect with these kids. And in microschooling, they're able to, these educators are able to create microschools where they really can thrive as educators and give the kids the opportunity to thrive the way that they never had in their prior settings. And so many of the microschool founders are military veterans themselves. James Lomax, who founded Life Skills Academy, Acton Academy in Las Vegas, who you met, but we didn't get to see his school, unfortunately, that day, flew jets for the Navy. And his private sector background as an engineer after he left the Navy gave him a strong sense of what needed to happen to prepare kids for their future that government monopoly systems were just not able to deliver in his experience, in his own personal experience and as a father. And so the military veterans creating microschools are an important lifeblood of all of this. And they bring to this an understanding about the need to connect with and understand individual kids and their needs that microschooling can do. That's just not possible if you're, even no matter how good a teacher you are, if you're serving 25 or 30 or 35 kids in your middle school classroom and have to run things a certain way, you just don't have the flexibility to do that you do in micro school.
Lots of flexibility, lots of different options for different families and different children's needs. I was inspired by all of the different options that you showed us. I mean, when we were on the ground doing the Permissionless Education Conference, you gave us tours of like half a dozen or so micro schools throughout the Las Vegas metropolitan area. And unbelievable how many different choices there are, how many different environments there are, and how there's something for everyone. And I love that. It's not a one-size-fits-all model. And even within a micro school, it's not a one-size-fits-all model for the individual students and participants of the education programs within that school. I love that. Real quick, ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to episode 16 of SPPI TV. We're talking with Don Soifer. Don Soifer is the chief executive officer and the founder, co-founder, with your wife, Ashley, at the National Microschooling Center. We're here today talking about what a microschool exactly is. Don, the National Microschooling Center is a 501c3 nonprofit. Is that correct?
That's right.
And you can learn about more about the National Microschooling Center at microschoolingcenter.org. There's a donate link on the website. Southwest Public Policy Institute is also a 501c3 nonprofit organization supporting the work of the National Microschooling Center, and the Southwest Public Policy Institute is only made possible by, I'm going to make a PBS plug, viewers like you and listeners like everybody that listens to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. I'm really enjoying this conversation. Don, where do you want to go next before we wrap things up in about 9 minutes?
Well, we would love to see microschooling really become part of the educational fabric in New Mexico, and helping people understand, what do I do? Do I join one? You don't have a lot of microschools to join in New Mexico. So we encourage people to, this is really something that you should do. You can do this, and we can help you do this. So anything to maybe help your good people understand what it takes to build microschools and get a robust base and sector of microschooling going in New Mexico, we'd love to help.
And we don't want to restrict it to just New Mexico. The Southwest Public Policy Institute does cover Oklahoma, Texas, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, and California. We actually have one of our board members up in Carson City at this point. His name is Greg Brooks. He works and manages the Better Cities Project. I need to get myself out there again soon. We weren't able to connect when we were at the AFSA conference earlier this year, which had us back in Las Vegas again. That seems to be a frequent destination for SPPI. But how can SPPI and other organizations like ours, the think tanks, the State Policy Network affiliates, the Atlas Network affiliates, how can we help advance the conversation when it comes to microschools and additional school choice options within and between the different states in the country?
Yeah. So those wonderful states that you mentioned, each have a very different educational landscape and frameworks within which you navigate. And the National Microschooling Center is more than happy to help you navigate what you need to work with within each of those states. I mean, if you're in Arizona, you have school choice vehicles that microschools can absolutely access. Colorado has some interesting and pretty compelling different models that you can get opportunities to do microschooling in creative and different and not even full-time ways, which is really compelling to me. So the National Microschooling Center runs free trainings, and we have a whole training program that starts with things like operational necessities and goes into the learning tool decisions and growth and how to track, how to begin to measure and track the academic growth of kids in your microschool, and how to do it in an active partnership with families, right? Because that's such an important part of this work. Microschooling families are generally much more current in where their child is with their teaching and learning. They're not waiting for the state standardized test scores to arrive at the beginning of the next school year, or even for that quarterly report card to come in. Microschools have different ways of demonstrating impact and sharing information with their families, but generally you find that microschooling families are much more active partners in their child's learning. So these are all things that you can do and you can set up. Microschool leaders come from different backgrounds. Only about half are traditional educators with, you know, licenses and, you know, currently or recently licensed educators. They come from different backgrounds. They come from different professional backgrounds. Their models can, you know, their models. So where do you house your microschool? About the most common arrangement for housing a microschool is in a commercial space. Patrick, you saw some that are in storefronts or a nonprofit space, church annexes, whether or not the microschool itself is affiliated with the church or teaching aligned with the teachings of the church. Houses of worship are great places for microschools to be based. Some microschools do things in their own home. There are three different types of microschools that we see. We see, let's start with provider network microschools. You read about Acton Academies or Prenda Academies or Primer or KIPOD. These are well-known groups, and sometimes for people that want to launch microschools but don't have a sense necessarily that they're ready to do this entirely as a business operation of their own, it makes sense for them to align with one of these provider networks, and we're more than happy to connect you with those. And sometimes that's a good way to go, or sometimes that's a good way to go while you start, and then eventually they want to become spread their own wings and grow on their own. Independent microschools are the second kind of microschools, and these are were there what a lot of people think about when they think about the pandemic pods or the alternative learning environments that popped up during the pandemic. But these are, whether they're based in people's homes or whether they're in a storefront, they're the individual vision of the microschool founder along with the founding families. And they tend to be, maybe on average, they're about 9 or 10 kids, 8, 9 or 10 kids, and they can be diversified in every way. And then finally, partnership microschools are a compelling aspect of the growth of the sector. I think that what we did with North Las Vegas is that we were an active partnership microschool. We were the nonprofit that was responsible for the teaching and learning, while the city, as an active partner, provided the rec center space and the non-teaching and learning staff and breakfast and lunch for kids every day. And a city has an IT department. So for a city that feels like it's been underserved by a county school district for a long time, this can be a really popular approach. The same thing can be said for houses of worship, can be host partners, professional associations. It's a tough time to be a law enforcement kid. And we've got some of those that are looking to do microschools for their own members. We're working with a rural library in rural Nevada that is using government dollars totally outside of education funding streams, but has a library and has a library staff that wants to serve kids in a place where the public schools are struggling for a lot of kids. So that as a partnership, a library is another great way to do things that can bring that, as sort of to circle back, be creative on both sides of the ledger and bring in dollars into schooling in innovative ways of doing it so that it can be affordable and equitably accessible to all kids so that everybody can have an opportunity to take advantage.
We talked about the different types of microschools that are available. And we talked before we started the podcast today about a particular section of your sector analysis that you completed earlier this year. You published that in April. That's available on the National Microschooling Center website at microschoolingcenter.org. But it's American Microschools, a Sector Analysis 2023. And I want to take a moment to dive into that report. We're going to take a look at page 15 specifically. Motivations yeah. behind why founders found these microschools. Let's talk about that for a minute.
I love it. Thank you. So people that think like you and me, people who believe in free market solutions to challenges and not relying on the government to solve its problems, like to think in terms of the entrepreneur. And often entrepreneur is a word that's applied to people that launch microschools, but it really does a disservice to suggest that these are people that are in it to make a buck. The motivations behind microschool founders tell a magnificent story of what it is about the sector that I think makes it so diversified, so sustainable, and I think such a place for thriving. So microschool leaders, and obviously there are entrepreneurs in it that see a business opportunity, or if they're an educator, they need to pay their bills. So there's an opportunity to create a way to generate revenue to keep things going on their own. But the for microschool founders, right, that providing opportunities for children to thrive that they had not been before. So kids from historically underserved or marginalized communities and giving them a chance to thrive. Afrocentric microschooling is a thing. It's a thriving movement, and it's an exciting part of the movement. Ways of serving the whole child, whether it be their social and emotional growth in a Christian sense or just social and emotional growth the way that other organizations measure it so that they can be sure that kids thrive is a crucial part of why so many microschool leaders do this. A specialized learning approach, whether it be Montessori or Waldorf or Forest Schools, or a movement that's really thriving in the sector. Lots of different ways of delivering models that families just don't have access to, that they couldn't pursue in other areas of education. I mean, Montessori is just not a not nearly as common as the incredible demand for it. And we've got some wonderful Montessori microschools. So what we did with the sector analysis, and just a brief word on the sector, right? So microschools as a sector are about where Catholic schools are in this country, about a 2% market share. And it's a tricky thing to measure, right? Because in so many states, microschools who are never going to see school choice dollars are a little bit under the radar and have sort of stayed that way.
And that's intentional.
Yeah, in some ways, in many cases, it is. And we are, you know, we hear from new people doing this all the time, including people that have been doing this for decades, that are just realizing that, oh, there are other people doing this, and are calling it microschooling. And it's, you know, they themselves have developed ways of doing things and deep relationships that matter within their own communities that are part of the fabric of a community, that one thing that the Microschool Center gets to do is bringing people together as a community to learn from their shared experiences. And they really do brighten up. So for people that are thinking about doing this, you have a lot of compatriots. You have a lot of other people that are part of this community and the fabric of this community that are supportive in all sorts of ways. The way I described Las Vegas, where sometimes a microschool leader will realize that maybe a kid would thrive better for a little while over here. Maybe here's a nature and ecology based microschool where this kid, or a different way of teaching math that would be great for this kid. And microschool leaders are, as a community, are incredibly supportive of each other. The center has affinity group programs and ongoing regular small group meetings so that people can share and learn from their experiences and their lessons learned and the challenges that they overcame. And that there are just so many people out there doing this. I truly believe that it's not outside the realm of possibility in the short, you know, in the short term to get to a 10% market share for microschooling. And a lot of that might be temporary, right? These might be families that have every intention of going back to traditional school to play linebacker or to play tuba, or they have a child with a bullying problem, or they don't get along with their fourth grade teacher, or for whatever reason, families are going to go back in, you have every plan to go back into more traditional schooling later on, or the family wants to travel, or we have fantastic competitive rodeo athletes in microschools. The nature of the way this is going to grow is phenomenal to watch and unexpected in so many ways. But as a sector, it really feels like this growth is sustainable in as many ways. And it's really a wonderful opportunity to have the chance to see up close. And please check in with us at the Microschooling Center. We'd love to include you in our work.
Don, I think we're all very excited to see the growth of the microschooling community over time. We've already seen explosive growth just in the last couple of years, and we're really thrilled with the progress that you've made with challenging the status quo. And we're here to support you, and I know that you're there to support us as we free more families from traditional failing public schools across the country. And I know that it's good work. It's worthwhile work. It's noble work. And thank you to you and your family for doing it. It's very much appreciated.
Our team stands by, would love to help and work with you guys and the good families that are part of your communities anytime we can.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Don. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to episode 16 of SPPI TV, What's a Microschool? I was joined today by Don Soifer, the Chief Executive Officer of the National Microschooling Center. Don, thank you so much for joining us. You took some time away from your family vacation. I know you're up in Western Canada right now. It was a pleasure to have you on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find out more about the Southwest Public Policy Institute at southwestpolicy.com. We had to do it a little early today. I know that Don's a little got some other plans this afternoon, so we appreciate him being flexible with our schedule, and I hope you understand that we're actually not going to be going live at 1 p.m. today, but that is covered. That episode was covered just now. Join in next week on SPPI TV episode 17. We've got a great guest lined up and can't wait to go live with them and talk more great things about how we can deliver better living through better policy at the Southwest Public Policy Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Patrick Brenner. I'm the president and founder of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. It was a pleasure joining you today. You can find out more at southwestpolicy.com. I'm signing off. I'll see you next week. Thank you so much again. Talk to you soon.